Okay, everybody, I think we're going to start off. Thank you very much to Anne for inviting me to chair the session. Now, social media is all about different voices, so here's a different voice for you. This is an authentic Glasgow accent. Hey, get in, yeah, woo. I'm in here just so that if you can't understand me, Matt will be much better than most of you. So that's the reason why. Also, I am part of the steering committee with Anne and Simon and everybody else. I'm delighted to be here. So we're going to have a hear from the last two scholars for today, Dr. Jenna Ng from University of York, and then from Matt Barr. So we'll run the same sort of setup as well. A scholar will speak and then we can take some questions and have a discussion about it. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. That's an introduction. Talking about accents, so this is a Singaporean accent. So I'm doing my bit.
Excellent.
To the room. Thanks as well, of course, to Anne, of course, to Crash for organizing this conference program and having me back. Before York, I was in Cambridge as a Liverpool early career fellow for 2 years. So it's good to be back, and thanks for having me. So my project is called Real-Time Event Collaborations Across Mixed and Transmedial Realities. But I thought before I explain what it is, like Suzanne, I thought I'll give you an idea of its genesis, really, so how it all began. And how it all began, so this project began out of another project. You can start to see, we can go back a long way here, but I'll just start with this other project. It was a roundtable seminar, which I organized, also at Crash, on Machinima. So can I have a show of hands? How many of you here in this room know what Machinima is? Okay, well, those two went for my seminar, so they didn't know. Well done, actually, this is a much better response than I expected. So Machinima are films that are made in virtual worlds. So these could be virtual worlds, could be game worlds, or increasingly social virtual worlds, like Second Life. Actually, Machinima started with gamers hacking into game worlds to make use of the game assets to make films in them. So like the avatars, the sets, the physics of the game, so they will use these game assets to make films in these worlds. And to cut a long story short, so I was organizing this this roundtable seminar, and 3 hours before the event, as such things go, I decided I had a good idea and decided I would actually stream this event in Second Life itself. It was a very logical reason. There was a lot of interest in these virtual worlds in this event, because these are games made in these worlds. People live in these places, right? And in the end, we only streamed the audio. It was very complicated. We couldn't get the Second Life viewer on this computer. It was actually in this room as well. So anyway, the point was that I had this event basically running in two places, in SG1, where you guys are now, and in Second Life itself. We sent out a notice in the forums. It was literally 2 hours before the event, and we didn't have that many avatars. We had about 7, and this is a picture of the event for Sneaker, but this is also the image that was taken of the event, of the Machinima event, one left after a while. But what was actually very gratifying, actually, was that there was a very active Second Life chat. A discussion going on. I mean, I have reams of this, I have about 10 pages of such text. And people, these avatars were basically just discussing among themselves. They were responding to the event. This wasn't fed back to what was happening in SG1. But they were part of the event. It was like a satellite discussion, if that makes sense. And I was very gratified to see that. One of them was actually worked at Jim Henson, 1036. My background is, I used to work at Henson. I worked as a science kid. I mean, you get amazing people like this coming to my event, which they wouldn't have if they weren't, you know, in Second Life. And if the event wasn't being held and streamed in Second Life. So I was very gratified by that. And then that was really when I started to have this thought about what can I do when I'm actually holding an event in SG1 in Cambridge? What can I do to actually make this event talk across spaces? Not just that, but also having satellite discussions, having an alternative set of ideas and discussions which can complement and enrich and be a part of yet separate from the original event. So that was the so that's basically what led to my current speaker project. What is it? It's about the use, the repurposing, the reconfiguration, the connection of digital spaces with physical spaces underpinning a real-time event. And questions that I started thinking, you know, how do we do this? And then I guess more importantly, how do we do this effectively? And then even more importantly after that, I started thinking, should we actually do this? And then there's something I'm also kind of wondering whether I should bring this up in this discussion. There wasn't really very much of a critical discussion about social media. People just, we assume, you know, of course it's good, it should be done. But I'm starting to have really second thoughts about it, and I will talk about it later. But for now, this is what my project was about. So, what did we do? We did two things. We held two workshops, and we wrote a practical toolkit on WordPress. And I say we, I'm the scholar, I'm the speaker scholar, but actually my partner in crime really did this with me, and he actually deserves more than half the credit, to be honest. And that's Jim Barrett, you will hear from him tomorrow, so I will steal his thunder, but yeah. So I organized the workshops, and he actually helped. So he actually did the work, and he wrote quite a bit of the toolkit as well. But we did two workshops, and one was, they were in February. They were two half-day workshops. One was on events management, and one was on knowledge economy. I think we had about 10 turn up for the first, and about 7 for the second. 10 was too many. 7 was good. So that's, well, I think it was also because of what we wanted to do, the workshops. We wanted it to be quite tailored to participants. We wanted it to be exploratory, so we wanted a lot of discussion and contribution for our participants. And you can't really go around too much with 10 people. But events management, the first workshop, was really more for the heritage people, you know, the librarians, people in museums, galleries. So it was about people who were actually mediating, organizing events, and we were giving, you know, the discussion was on how we could mediate that event. Workshop 2 was really more for the virtual academic. I'm not sure we really mastered that division very well. People sort of just came for both. Well, but that was the idea. And so we had, I don't think you can really see, because I can't really see, but we had the digital knowledge economy, you know, we had tools for change, the digital components of professional life, things like that. So that was the strategy, the format, the outline of the workshops. We wanted this to be very tailored to people's issues, problems. So, you know, they'll come to us. The standard format is that you come to us with events you want to mediate, and we will discuss it and provide strategies that could effectively mediate the event. So this was a discussion we had. We had them in groups, and then they wrote their this is bringing back this is it, right? And and they wrote their strategies on these post-its, which we then put on the board, and we discussed them. And then we, you know, these were some of the issues that we went through: the audience, the ethics, tools, archiving. And the second workshop was a fewer people, and each person came up with a digital object they wanted to make. And again, you know, we ran around the group. There's this creaky bit of SG1, and I've noticed it in the last 2 years, and it makes me feel very heavy, but I'm sorry about that. I'm trying to avoid the creaky bit. So, you know, what someone wanted to do, the database, an app, a project in transition. DH23 was Ruth's project, and a network. And basically, we just went around the group, so Jim provided the expert guidance, and the group also provided ideas, and that's how we held the workshops. This is the toolkit. It is very, very new. In fact, it is so new, it's kind of completed like last night. We should link it to the speaker website. Sorry, it hasn't been. We should also start tweeting it now. transmedialreality.wordpress.com. And I'll just skip here quite quickly and just go into, I'm gonna play around. This is it, yeah. So it's really, you know, it's really a toolkit. identifying practical tools for using inventory management. If you want to tweet, blog, quotation, sharing backup. It's basically just a list of software, mostly of them being free, you know, Jing, Copernicus, Camtasia, if you want to make screen captures, ripping of video. Yeah, so it's basically, it's a toolkit. If you want to do something, we will give you suggestions as to which programs you can use to do it. So we hope it'll be handy. We'll put some kind of analytics on it perhaps to track. And it's WordPress, so it will be there forever and ever. So it's a toolkit, and that's it. Start tweeting about it now, and we will disseminate it in other ways and link it as well. Okay. So those are two things that we did. Then part three is what do we learn? I put out four items. I didn't really want four because it's an unlucky number for the Chinese, but I didn't have time for five, and three was too little, so I went with four. This was things that we did learn, that I learned, that I got from the workshops, but there are also thoughts which I have been thinking a lot about through today, but also through my own social media usage. So I framed them as questions, which maybe we could talk about. Okay. Like Jeopardy style, right? So what is a social? So the other day, I had a friend, and he's a scientist, he's a physicist, and he came to me and said, my university asked me what kind of social media we use in our research. And I said, cool, you know, what did you say? And he said, researcher ID and research gate, right? Do you know? Does anyone here know what they are, right? They're basically databases where you put in your name and your publications, your research interests. It's to help you find collaborators, basically. And I said, yeah, that's kind of cool, it's very sweet, but basically, where is the social, you know? It's a one-way interaction. You are just being seen. It's a way to make you visible. What is the social? I think most of us in this room would say the social has to be a two-way thing. Right? It's about interaction. It's about exchange. Right? It's about communication or dialogue. So this is research ID. So basically, it's about you putting yourself out there. So you're reaching out, but nobody comes back to you, right? So I thought, so this is what the social is, right? It's about this exchange, it's communication, and that's cool. Then I thought, but that's also kind of the problem, right? Because if we're all in this dialogue together, then what about those people who aren't? And really, you know, I'm an evangelist about this, and I always thought, well, you know, if you're not on Twitter, then get on Twitter. You know, we hold workshops, right? Helen Webster at the back, my ex-colleague. I mean, crash, we do this. We hold these social media workshops, you know. How do you open a Twitter account? So, open a Twitter account, get onto it, get into the conversation. It's really not hard. And I was thinking, but actually it's not really that simple, is it? Because, you know, you cannot join the conversation for various reasons. Why is it become such an unquestioned good in a way to be part of this conversation, right? I know people who don't tweet in conferences just because they don't bring a laptop to the conference. I'm also starting to refrain and stay a little bit away from the tweeting just because I'm very concerned about what I'm putting out there for various reasons. It's just become an issue that I've been sort of thinking that it's really not that simple how we think about the inclusion and exclusion of this dialogue, if this is what the social is, and the power structures of this dialogue. So that was just something that I was thinking about. What is the social? And then the second thing I thought about is, okay, what is the social part two? And this is about voices. So my concern for part two is that who are the voices that we are not hearing on social media? And are some voices louder than others? And that's some of this is very straightforward, right? We know Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian. I mean, people who are paid celebrities, who are famous for whatever reason, are paid certain amounts, and their voice is pretty loud, right? But I'm realizing that this is a worrying trend for me anyway. I'm realizing that actually people who are now sharing on social media on a voice that is louder. You see, what's underpinning the social media for me anyway is the egalitarian platform of it, right? It's about being heard, making your voice heard. It's about you and me getting our message out. So it's not just about the mainstream media companies, it's not just about big powerful companies or politicians. But if some voices are being made louder than others, then where is the egalitarianism in that? And that to me was very worrying. So this is what they call super sharers, which is what I was worrying me about. Advertisers must approach video super sharers with care, right? So super sharers identify as these people who share videos 5 times in 60 days. If you do that, you're a super sharer. And the companies, the marketing companies, go for you because you are that loud voice. But why should you be a loud voice? If all our voices are supposed to matter equally on this platform called social media, because that is the social, right? This is an ad, it's called Ad Buffer. Just read the, you know, be awesome on social media, easily add great articles, pictures, and videos to your buffer, and we automatically share them with you through the day. My point is, there is this ratcheting of this sharing, which is worrying to me. Should we be making so much noise? Should we be so loud? Who should be so loud on social media? To me, this is a question of power structure. So, yeah. So that was something that was also a thought that was going through my mind. Part three is where to put it. So I mentioned that I was from Cambridge and I've moved to York. Before Cambridge, I was in Sweden. And before Sweden, I was in Hong Kong. Before Hong Kong, I was in London. And before London, I was in Singapore, where I originally came from. My point is, I've moved a lot through my life, and I don't carry stuff with me. Where do I put it? I put it in the cloud, basically. I don't carry books, DVDs. No, I put all my media, I have 5,000 PDFs, and I put it in the 300 gigabyte portable hard drive that weighs, you know, 200 grams. If I could put my clothes on the cloud, I would. But I move with as few things as I can. So where to put it, I put it in the cloud. I put it in something as light as possible. What's my point? My point is social media, right? All these data that we're all whizzing about, right? It is really, you know, where is it? Where is that put? Right? It's put in the cloud as well, right? And who owns the clouds, right? It's Google, it's Yahoo, right? Who used Delicious in this room? Well, there we go. Now you know what I'm talking about. And what happens when those platforms go? What did I write? It's more than being bereft of something very precious, about losing integral parts of your life. This is about a certain oblivion to a catastrophe that's too horrible to contemplate. So, you know, my point is, this is an extremely ephemeral, extremely delicate, and extremely fragile infrastructure. And it is really underpinned by nothing more than just a sheer blind faith that life as we know it will go on forever and ever. So I'm starting to use notebooks now. But where is the social in that? You know, but it is something to, well, I don't know, it worries me. Okay, part four. What is the language of social media? This one I thought was interesting. So media scholars, this obviously takes from Lev Manovich's book, The Language of New Media. It's the language of social media. Yeah, I know it's not that clever, right? But I thought this was important because the social is about communication. That's also part of what is the social. And it's about how we're making sense and how we're transmitting information and how we are communicating ourselves to others. So at the moment, the way I see it, it's still very much about photographs, still images, and text. Cool. The next big thing that everybody is pointing at, actually, make a guess. What do you think it is? Mm-hmm. Sorry?
Video?
Video, absolutely, yeah.
So Skype apparently is talking about, well, Skype is real-time conversation, right, with text and with voice. And now they want to talk about video conversations. You make a video of something and you post it on Skype, and then somebody else will make a reaction video and post it on Skype, and you have a video conversation. Personally, I don't think it sounds very appealing, but hey, you know, if Skype thinks it's going to work, who am I to say it won't? But so there is that. And obviously we have Vine, from which is the most downloaded app. So Vine is an app which lets you record 6-second video clips. It's a Twitter application, and then you post it on Twitter. And then what Twitter does, Facebook will do as well. So Facebook has got Instagram video. And I'm horrified that Justin Bieber apparently he's doing his Instagram video. But yeah, that's the extent they will go to promote video. If Google Glass does hit the market, so Google Glass is the augmented reality glasses, which Google is, and is set to be launched later this year. And it's got a camera in it, right? That's the whole big problem with it, because it will record you and all these privacy issues. But anyway, there's a camera in it. And basically, you just tap sort of the arm of the glasses and operate the camera. So basically, recording video is going to be as easy as making a phone call. And how is that? What is that going to do with the language with which we share, you know, the language of social media? But that is set for launch later this year. And in the meantime, what I think would just do it for video, right, is what I'm going to show you next. And I've watched this about 20 times, and I just still go like, wow, right? So it's really cool, okay? So if you could, yeah, thanks, Matt. So I've got the volume. You ready? Okay. Watch what's on their heads. These are wearable computers, basically. They're hands-free cameras, wearable cameras. Oh, it's okay, I'm going to play some more. So. Wearable cameras, so they're hands-free cameras. And apparently, journalists now, when they go out, they will bring one of these with them, because it is just so spontaneous. You know, if you want to capture something, you don't have to whip out gear and everything. It's just like on your head. It is changing digital capture, and that in turn is changing the way the world is seen. And I think that will also be part of this new language, which we will see developing, and social media will be part of it. I also think, and here I'm just going to go out on a limb, and you know, I also think experience, particularly the physical experience, is also going to be part of this new language of social media. And in this, I see us going back to the analog. So what I'm going to show you next is the Burberry's Kiss Over Distance. Has anyone seen this one? But yeah, so it's the kiss, right? Which is a very sensual, it's very intimate, it's a very physical experience. And that is expressed digitally as an imprint, as the trace of lips on the phone screen. And this idea of the imprint, the trace, this is the aesthetic of the analog. It, you know, it's imprint of light on film, right, which is the photograph, is the trace of a mark signifying time and presence. It is the physicality of touch. So the fingerprint, the photograph, the death mask, not the mediation of a computer code of zeros and ones, that is the hallmark of the digital. So I just think it's interesting because this is about digital communication, but it is using the analog to transmit that, the analog age of direct contact about trace and imprints and touch. So, Burberry Kisses. Entirely by chance, a couple of weeks ago, I was watching old episodes from my old TV sitcom program and came across another take on the same idea of the kiss across distance. I won't say too much of that here. I'm just going to show it and I'll end my paper with that. I'll just say that it's a lot more literal than the kiss, and you'll see what I mean. And it's meant to be funny. But, you know, everything that's a bit ridiculous, actually, I think there's also sort of a bit of truth in it. So I think that this might actually just be also the next wave of social media, from the imprint to the haptic, and one day our entire sensorium. André Bazin writes of the myth of total cinema. You can tell I'm a media film scholar. Right? André Bazin writes of the myth of total cinema, which is of cinema's ultimate destiny as the total representation of our world. Perhaps social media's own myth is that of total sensorium, of life, of experience, of movements and speed and sensuality, and the joy of being. I'll leave it here and I'll end my talk with this last clip. This is from The Big Bang Theory.
Right, you're having trouble with the long-distance lovemaking? This is your answer. There are two interfaces that simulate a human mouth. You have one, Priya has one in India. When you move your lips and tongue on yours, it transmits exactly what you're doing to her. So, see? Internet kissing. Like this. Almost. Really get your tongue in there to activate the motion sensor. Like this. Huh. Really French it. Better? Yeah, you got it.
I'm impressed. This is very lifelike.
Everything weird.
Sorry.
Thank you.